This week kicked off the 2018 primary election season with primaries in four states: Ohio, Indiana, North Carolina, and West Virginia. I'm Kay McIntyre, and today on KPR Presents, a preview of the August primary elections in Kansas. A group of political scientists and analysts gathered on April 6, 2018 at Washburn University in Topeka. We'll hear from Dwayne Gosin, former budget director for the state of Kansas, Michael Smith of Emporia State University, Burdette Loomis of the University of Kansas, Ed Flinchy, who used to teach at Wichita State University, and from Bob Beatty of Washburn University. Each of the panelists writes for Insight Kansas, a syndicated newspaper column that reaches about 20 newspapers across the state. Washburn University's Bob Beatty begins with a quick overview of the past decade in Kansas politics.
Going back to 2010, that was a big change in the state of Kansas. Obviously, the clean sweep by Governor Brownback and the Republicans, all the state offices, and all the federal offices were won by Republicans, and most of the offices were won by conservative Republicans. And when Sam Brownback came into office with a conservative, what would be eventually a completely conservative legislature, there was a number of major changes that he and the legislature wanted to enact. But obviously, one of the most famous, and we're talking nationally famous, is the tax cuts of 2012, and those were massive tax cuts on individuals and corporations in the state of Kansas. And one of Governor Brownback's main goals, and this was not a secret, not controversial, if he was sitting here, he couldn't deny it because he said it in his State of the State addresses, was to make Kansas a model for the rest of the nation. Keep in mind that in 2010 and onward, those were the Obama years. And so Governor Brownback wanted to address some very conservative issues such as school funding and make Kansas sort of a guiding light for the rest of the nation. In his 2013 State of the State, he said, quote, "My focus is to create a red state model that allows the Republican ticket, presidential ticket, to say, quote, see, we've got a different way it works. So create a red state model." So really, that's going to tie into what he said about his tax cuts, which were an experiment. He wanted to have the results of this experiment to be able to take to other states around the union and at the presidential level as well. In 2014, Brownback wins re-election, 49.8% to 46.1%. So it was quite close. One of their strategies was to nationalize this election, and based on the results, it worked. One thing I would point out was that for whatever reasons, the Democratic ticket of Paul Davis and Jill Docking did not energize Democrats and unaffiliateds in the state. The turnout was stagnant. It was not any higher than it might have been in any other election, and a lot of people were sort of surprised by that. But after 2014, the party is over. Literally within days after Brownback is reelected, a budget report comes out saying that Kansas is deep in the hole, budget-wise. Okay. So since 2014, really things got worse in the sense, especially with the budget. And so from 2014 to 2016, revenues tank. They had been going down, but they continued to tank. The Brownback administration and the legislature took money from highways. They raised the sales tax. A lot of people in Kansas aren't quite clear about that. There is this association that there was, because of the tax cuts, that Brownback and the Republicans were the big tax cutters. They raised sales tax to offset, in part, some of those tax cuts, and Kansas now has the highest sales tax on food in the nation. Okay. Moderates then regained, in the legislature, regained the House in 2016. Brownback became very unpopular. At one point, he was the least popular governor in the entire country. His approval ratings averaged about 25% from 2014 till he left, and disapproval ratings of close to 75%. Not very good. As I mentioned, in 2016, the legislative races, many moderate Republicans and more Democrats won. And that allowed the legislature to override Brownback's veto and rescind those tax cuts. Okay, so that was a national story, but also an important story in the state of Kansas. Governor Brownback left, got out of not only got out of Dodge, but got out of the entire state. He left the state of Kansas in early 2008. He was appointed by Donald Trump to be ambassador for religious freedom. So that's a very obviously quick recap of the Brownback years. Very exciting. And so I asked the question, is this, you know, with the departure of Brownback and the elections of 2018, is it a return to normalcy? Or as General Chang said in Star Trek VI, not Shakespeare, but General Chang, once more unto the breach. So the question is, in the governor's race, will moderates, whether they're moderate Republicans or Democrats, will they rise back in the state of Kansas, or will there be a continuation of the Brownback policies? And the same, there's a twist on that, but it's the same is true. We'll discuss in the congressional races. Essentially, will Democrats be able to be competitive or even win a seat? And with that, I turn it over to Ed Flinchy, who's going to tell us a bit about the Republican side of the gubernatorial race.
Thanks, Bob. I'm going to limit my remarks to four candidates that are in the race, so to speak. Jeff Collier, recently elevated to the governorship, Chris Kobach, Secretary of State, Jim Barnett, former Republican gubernatorial candidate, and Ken Seltzer, our current insurance commissioner. This is where a lot of the excitement's going to take place, although Byrd may suggest it's going to be elsewhere. I think most of the noise is going to come out of this Republican primary in the next 3 months. Let's take a quick look at these four. Collier and Kobach are well-credentialed. Collier, a medical doctor, actually plastic surgeon, most of his adult life in Johnson County. He was a White House fellow, worked with the International Medical Corps, a Georgetown bachelor's degree, a Cambridge University graduate degree, and a KU medical doctor. He was elected to the House originally in 06, then elected to the state Senate in 08, then joined Sam Brownback in 2010 as lieutenant governor. For the most part, he and Brownback have been attached at the hip, hardly any distance at all, certainly for 7 years between them. His main claim to fame, I believe, is as architect of what has become known as CanCare. That's the privatization of Medicaid, essentially turning over administration of Medicaid to three national, international insurance companies. I'm going to compare each of these candidates on a poll done by the Docking Institute at Fort Hays. They do regular polls on Kansas Speaks. I cannot say much about the quality of the poll. It's based on 367 adults older than 18 across the state. But it is one measure that is looked at each of these four. In that poll, and that was taken late March, early April, Collier had name ID of 55%. He trailed Kobach significantly. His favorable, unfavorable ratings were essentially equal. So gives you one measure of where he stands. He has made some political moves in this race that I think show some insight into this primary. First, he's distinguished himself on school funding by essentially embracing legislative initiative in that regard, to a lesser degree on immigration. But I think just yesterday, he probably made the most significant move in that his budget amendments put forward to the legislature took the additional revenue, or suggested that any additional revenue be used to fill some budget holes. So I think those are fairly significant moves to distinguish himself from Kobach. He has also tried to distinguish himself from Brownback in the foster care area, the Department of Children and Families, that's been a mess. I don't know if he'll make any progress there. He has, the third thing I've noticed, he is doing his best to highlight his rural connection in two ways. First, highlighting being raised in Hayes out west, and also selecting a lieutenant governor who's also a far west resident. His political liabilities mostly relate to being attached to Brownback, a toxic brand right now. But even more than that, the daily messes we read about in the paper in state government that Brownback has left. And I doubt that his CanCare Association will be an asset to him going forward. Moving quickly to Kobach. He was a Republican nominee for Congress in the Kansas City area in 2004, but lost to Dennis Moore. Elected Secretary of State in 2010, big wave election, reelected in 2014. His claim to fame, if you would call it that, is being the architect of the voter ID law, which once implemented has been tied up in federal court for most of its existence. He was an early Trump supporter in the 2016 presidential election. His son held a fundraiser for Trump's son held a fundraiser for Kobach last fall. 85% name ID, hard to beat that. But his unfavorable is 30-50. So 50% of those folks who know him have an unfavorable opinion of him. He's running strong to the right, grandstanding still on illegal voting. He's a columnist for the ultra-right Breitbart website. He has gone after, his political moves are to try to get Collier to defend a variety of things, and Kobach seems to have nothing of that. Kobach did place Wink Hartman on the ticket with him as lieutenant governor, Hartman being a Wichita resident who started in the race and then dropped out. Political liabilities for Kobach, the high disapproval ratings. I also believe that his standing in rural counties that make up a good bit of the vote will, and his alliance with Trump will hurt him on issues like trade and immigration. He is constantly in litigation. He's got two contempt of court citations. Litigation seems to follow him wherever he goes. He was kind of an architect of the Trump Voter Fraud Commission, which kind of was a disaster. Moving to Jim Barnett. Jim Barnett, originally from Emporia, elected to the state Senate three times, starting in 2000. Republican nominee for governor in 06. He won, prevailed in a seven-candidate race. He also ran for Congress in 2010, but was defeated in the primary by Huskamp. His name ID in that Kansas Speaks poll is 41%, certainly way back in the pack in that regard. But his favorable, unfavorable is almost 2-1. So those folks who know him do have a favorable opinion of him. He has become a full-throated centrist Republican, endorsing Medicaid expansion. He's an out-and-out critic of the tax experiment, supports public school funding. He is one of the few that has actually said, I endorse the income tax changes made last year. He was in Wichita a week ago, and I hadn't heard this. He called for undoing CanCare, which is, again, Collier's main thing. His a huge liability for him is just not being known and kind of being out of state politics for some time. Then quickly, Ken Seltzer, Johnson County, businessman, CPA for his adult life, elected insurance commissioner in 2014 in a five-candidate primary. Name ID is 21%, slightly more favorable than unfavorable, but very trailing all three other candidates. Initially billed himself as a thoughtful, calm decision maker, but his some of his first TV ads say, I'm the real Trump in the candidate, in the of the candidates. So I don't know quite where that is. Very low name ID is his main liability. I have written and tried to convince my colleagues here that this vote will really be decided in the rural counties of Kansas, even though the five largest urban counties have nearly 50% of the vote. That vote, in my opinion, and history bears this out, is going to get split. All these four candidates are essentially urban county candidates. So I think this will be won or lost. If the election were held today, I think it'd be Kobach. However, it's 3 months, and a lot can happen in the campaign. I think Kobach will fade, and Collier will gain from that. If the campaign gets really nasty, I could see Jim Barnett actually emerging. It doesn't look like Seltzer's in it right now.
All right, thank you, Ed, and I'm sure there will be some questions on the Republican side. Now we move to Dr. Loomis for the Democratic side in the gubernatorial race.
So the first thing I'd like to make clear and really emphasize above virtually everything else is as opposed to, say, 2010 when there was a wave election, or 2000 Democrats, or 2006 for Republicans when Kathleen Sebelius pretty much easily won re-election, but focusing on the Democrats right now, it's really worth having the nomination this year. I don't think there's any question that a Democrat, and I think any of the four major candidates could win. I wouldn't say they will win by any stretch of the imagination. But we tend to think of this as a Republican state, and yet Democrats have won the governorship over the last 50 or 60 years almost half the time. So, and particularly they win when Republicans don't do well. And I don't think anyone can argue that Brownback has done well. He leaves office highly unpopular. So I'll be much briefer on terms of the rundown. Jim Ward, the minority leader from Wichita, feisty, working. I think he's working hard. Josh Vaughty was a legislator, then for 10 months was ag secretary, worked for the EPA, and has worked at the Land Institute, is a farmer, very attractive candidate. His distinguishing characteristic, I don't think with any question, is that he's pro-life, which is a real problem in a Democratic primary. Carl Brewer, the mayor, Democratic mayor of Wichita, elected twice as a Democrat in Wichita, African-American. Certainly, that in itself offers some substantial evidence that he can pull votes from Republicans and independents. And finally, Laura Kelly from Topeka, the last person into the race, got in mid-December. I never saw Laura with her arm in a sling, but I'm pretty sure that it was twisted, you know, substantially in the fall. In fact, I know it was just twisted substantially in the fall, most notably by former Governor Sebelius, who she lived next to in Topeka, and who worked very hard to get her into the race. So I think you've got four qualified candidates. Certainly on paper, they're qualified candidates, much as the Republicans are. Right now, there are very few markers. Glad Chapman Rackaway is now in Georgia, so I would have to trash that. I have no idea why they ran that poll. Just favorable, unfavorables. It told you nothing. I'd wait for a little while and then do a poll that where it would have some meaning. But it was a ridiculous poll, except for the fact of Kobach. I think Kobach's numbers are very important. High recognition, very high negatives. I think that's really significant. So there are very few markers right now. Laura Kelly got in the race in mid-December, 2 weeks into the race. The reporting for funding. Boddy had a little more money than she did, but he'd been at it for over a year. She was at it for 2 weeks and got $155,000 and has not stopped. I can tell you that from at least secondhand experience. So I think that, honestly, the moment she got into the race, she became the front runner for a variety of reasons. I think she has the greatest access to resources, to money, both money that would be given to her personally and from outside sources. She's the only woman in the race, which I think is very significant in Kansas politics, particularly among Democrats, independents, moderate Republicans, without question. And she's also the only candidate from, and here's really the mirror, the flip on Ed's perspective. She's the only candidate from Northeast Kansas, where the bulk of votes are, particularly in a Democratic primary. And Josh Vaughty's gone out to every county. There are not a hell of a lot of Democratic votes out in some of those counties. I mean, you know, you could, you know, shoot a howitzer and not hit a Democrat. So it's, you know, great to be out there. And everyone will go out there. But in reality, in a Democratic primary, it's the Northeast corridor here where I think that election will be decided. If we move the general election very quickly, again, this is why the nomination is worth having. Number one, if it's Kobach, it's really worth having, because his electoral ceiling is very low in terms of how many people are opposed to him. But I think that regardless of it's Kobach or Collier, and I think those are the two realistic possibilities right now, Democrats will have a substantial number amount of national resources. And if Kobach's a nominee, a tremendous amount of national resources. Kobach will attract some, but the opposition to Kobach is around the country. It's a national, polarizing national figure. And the idea of for national Democrats to go into a pretty cheap state, Kansas, this isn't, you know, Illinois that's going to spend $300 or $400 million on a governor's race. Pretty cheap state, and try to knock off someone like Kobach would be just too tantalizing. So I think Democrats will have a lot of resources, both the party to an extent, the candidate to a greater extent, but really outside money even more so. I got to mention of course the elephant in the room, whatever, and that's Greg Orman. Greg Orman, 4 years ago, ran against Pat Roberts, was a senator, and did a respectable job. The Democrat in that race, Chad Taylor, DA from this county, dropped out. So it was essentially a one-on-one. And Orman says, I'm not a Democrat, but he essentially was a Democrat. And in the end, a lot of national money came in. The Senate might have been at stake, and Pat Roberts prevailed. I also, my argument would also be that Pat Roberts' money helped Sam Brownback limp over the finish line, but that's another story. So Orman, one-on-one, lost by 11 percentage points. An okay effort, but not great. Now he wants to come back and say, you know, I'm the moderate here, blah, blah, blah. I'm the one that, should be elected here because the Democrats and Republicans are fighting like cats and dogs, and I have the answers. Look, you're going to hear from two congressional races where Democrats have a very good chance to win a seat. You've got House races, state House races, where Democrats have a chance to pick up 5, 7, 8, or 9 seats, maybe. Democratic Party is not going to roll over for Greg Orman or anyone else. So his vision of this is a fantasy. But he runs and gets 20% of the vote. Most of that's coming from moderate Republicans, independents, some Democrats. Be very, very hard for a Democrat to overcome that. I don't think it's impossible if you got Orman down to, if he ran, was in 10, 12, 13% range. I've talked to some smart people who think that could be done, but it's still very hard. So it's really a Republican, a Democrat, and Greg Orman's ego. For a Democrat, where you have a really good chance this year, one of the great frustrations is that it could be decided by someone who doesn't really have a chance to win coming into the race.
Tell us what you really feel, Dr.
No, Lee. I'm too shy.
I know we'll have lots of questions for the gubernatorial race. I will have some if we certainly don't get them from the audience. And now I'd like to briefly talk about the second district congressional race, like the gubernatorial race. This is ultra competitive. It's on the national radar. Ads have already been booked. And you can go to the FEC. You can type in TV stations, and their public reports will come up. You go to their political files, and you can see the ads, KSNT, WIBW, Wichita. The Republicans have already booked ads here in Topeka for the second district race, and I'm sure the Democrats will be soon. So they're getting their money in early for that. It's going to be a big race. So the second district obviously covers a strip going from north to south, east Kansas, from Leavenworth down to Pittsburgh, and Parsons and Insight Kansas writers. Their columns are in the Parsons Sun, so they go all the way down south. And, of course, covers Topeka and Manhattan. So a very interesting district with some urban areas, some military bases, and of course, rural areas. Lynn Jenkins has been the representative for a number of years, but most famously, it can flip, and it has. Nancy Boida took it away from Jim Ryan in 2006, and then she lost it in 2008. Okay, so there is a very strong Democrat in this race. There's been some people have really liked some of the Democrats that have run in the second district over the last few years. However, they didn't have the resources or the name recognition to really make a go of it against the incumbent Lynn Jenkins. Paul Davis, coming off a gubernatorial race in which tens of millions of dollars were spent pro and against his name recognition, is sky high. And so, in many ways, for the Democrats, he is a perfect candidate. Now, some interesting statistics that you'll want to think about for this second district race is that in 2014, Paul Davis won the second district against Sam Brownback, 51% to 45%. 2 years later, Donald Trump won 56% to 37%. But keep in mind that Donald Trump was running against Hillary Clinton. And so what we see here is what I'll talk about a little bit later, is that I think we can already see that Paul Davis will be, the Republicans, smartly, are going to try to brand him as Hillary Clinton. Okay? They do not want voters in the second district to think of him as Paul Davis. So when they know that people voted against Hillary Clinton only 2 years ago. So it's an interesting dichotomy there about the second district. So Paul Davis he doesn't really have any competition. Nathan Schmidt has made some intimations on Facebook and other places, a former city council member in Topeka, that he's running. It's hard to find much a campaign there. And I think Paul Davis will win the nomination. The key for Paul Davis here, and Republicans are already complaining about it, is that he's fundraising right now for the general. And like Laura Kelly, Dr. Loomis mentioned Laura Kelly is furiously fundraising. Paul Davis is furiously fundraising to the tunes of hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars. So by the time the September comes around, he should be in pretty good shape. Okay. Now, what about his Republican opponents here in the second district? Well, I call it the quote, adventure is our middle name, unquote, primary, because I was actually, this is a fascinating primary for the on the Republican side. We have one candidate, Steve Fitzgerald, who's put out an ad likening himself to the Dos Equis spokesman. He's got an internet ad that shows up, by the way, when I go on YouTube, because I'm a nerd and so I look up political stuff. So Fitzgerald is actually already paying to advertise on YouTube, where he says he's the most interesting man in Kansas. He looks a little bit like the guy, so I can see where it's coming from, and it's a very clever ad. We have another candidate, Steve Watkins, who was in the Iditarod and has been touring around some local schools talking about his experiences. But we have another candidate, Kevin Jones, who appeared on America Ninja Warrior. So my goodness, what a primary we have here on the Republican side. We also have already had a candidate drop out, and he's not the VA nominee, Ronnie Jackson. It's Antonio Suave, worked in Brownback's cabinet, and had some allegations against him involving some possible improprieties, involving some financial matters that I won't get into, but he was in, he's already out. So who's left? Well, we have, as I mentioned, State Senator Steve Fitzgerald goes by the name Colonel Fitz, and you're going to see a military theme in this primary. One of the reasons is it can be a very rural district. But Colonel Fitz is a very conservative and an avid Trump supporter. And in my researches, I actually discovered a YouTube video of Colonel Fitz preaching in Oklahoma City on the street. So I just found that yesterday. I have no idea what it's all about. But, you know, that's an aspect of Colonel Fitz that I didn't know about. So he has some very strong supporters in the Republican Party in the second district. Here, and so he's a very viable candidate and could very well win. I mentioned Steve Watkins. He's an outsider. He hasn't held a political office before, And on his website and his materials, he stresses his military experience. And as I mentioned, his sort of that can-do attitude. And he and Kevin Jones, who I'll mention later, remind me of Adam Taft, who ran for Congress a few years ago up in the 3rd District, who'd been in the military. So again, that military experience to show you're a real up-and-comer. And they also, in their website, say that they want to bring that attitude to Congress. Okay. Tyler Tannehill also served in the military. You may have heard of him because after the shooting in Florida, he had an AR-15 giveaway as a promotional aspect of his campaign, and he actually appeared on some national television shows. So he got him some attention. He recently did an op-ed in the Capital Journal because Colonel Fitz said that everyone needs to drop out and rally behind him. And I don't blame Fitzgerald for doing that. It was a nice try, but Tannehill said, no, I think we should stay in the race, okay? And Kevin Jones is a member of the House in the legislature, and also emphasizing his military background, okay? So again, we're seeing this adventure military theme coming out of the Republican side. Vernon Fields, we haven't heard much from him. He's from Basehor on the city council. I did look it up, and he actually did serve in the military Matt Bevin's dropped out, so the only candidate that hasn't served in the military is Karen Tyson, state senator. Now, there was a straw poll in Atchison during the Republican debate. She won the straw poll. That would be your establishment Republicans that would show up for a debate in Atchison. They had to pay $15 to watch it anyway. I don't really think it's much indication in what's going to be a really high turnout Republican August primary of where this race is. I think this race could be anywhere on the Republican side. We've got the potential to have a Steve Watkins, for example, come out and people really see his commercials. Wow, this guy was in the Iditarod, really like him. And it's possible the Republicans could grab on to a newcomer, or a Kevin Jones. So it's really tough to say. Or maybe Steve Fitzgerald appeals to that Trump, very conservative side in the 2nd District. This is just one of the most fascinating Republican primaries in a Republican state that I've ever seen. In terms of fundraising, what's interesting about the fundraising is the numbers don't look too bad. If you're a Republican, you're saying, wow. Tyson, Fitzgerald has 300,000 plus. Tyson has 300,000 plus. Watkins, wow, they're really raking in the money. But it only takes a few minutes to dig into it to find that a lot of that money is the candidates themselves either loaning or giving themselves money. So, literally one of the candidates, I think it was Fitzgerald, it was over 200,000 of the two. Of the 300 was his own money, okay? So in a way, that's good. They're investing in their own campaigns. On the other hand, they're having trouble fundraising from people that don't share their last name. That's not a great sign for the national Republicans, and the national Republicans are worried about it. Okay, Paul Davis hasn't given his own campaign a penny. And these candidates are giving themselves a lot of money, and they should, because as I said, it's a wide open race. If you're going to invest in this, it's probably the time to do it. The Trump factor is also very large in the 2nd District. Fitzgerald and Tyson have both openly talked about Donald Trump. Fitzgerald's been very open about supporting Trump, but recently Karen Tyson said, quote, I think Kansans, and what was interesting was she didn't say the 2nd District, but she said, Kansans are still supportive of the president. The people that we're talking to, they like his agenda, what he ran on, campaigned on, but for the most part, they like what he's doing, unquote. So Tyson has said, put herself with Trump, and as I've mentioned before, I think rather, the Republicans will try to nationalize this race. So if you thought that Trump Clinton was over with and we can move on, not in the 2nd District. And I read a New York Times article that said that Hillary Clinton is going to play in a number of congressional districts, and I think the 2nd District will be one of them. The Kansas City Star had a recent article where they talked to a number of people about this race in the 2nd District. Republicans, anonymously, are not happy about the field. They wanted Derek Schmidt, the Attorney General, or they wanted a bigger name, maybe even someone who wasn't in politics but had a big name. You know, Jim Ryan, years ago, ran and won in the 2nd District, incredibly high name recognition. So one Republican consultant said this is one of the weakest fields he's seen. And of course, as we know in politics, a guy like Paul Davis can also scare away candidates because Davis has that fundraising ability, okay? But however, the Kansas Republican, the chair of the Kansas Republican Party said the Democrats have their candidate, Paul Davis. We know he lost to Brownback, okay? And we know about him. So he said, quote, we know what his flaws are. We know how to attack and campaign against him as a party. So to me, that's signaling, again, that strategy of we beat him by linking him to Barack Obama and the National Democrats. We're going to do that again, regardless of who the nominee is from our side. So essentially, I'm saying get ready for a scorched earth campaign in the 2nd District. Get ready to see Ted Kennedy, Nancy Pelosi, Obama, maybe, although maybe now that he's out of office, that one may not be so good. But definitely Pelosi. We saw Ted Kennedy a couple years ago. He appeared in the Roberts Orman race. And definitely Hillary Clinton. Okay. Now, this nationalization has worked in Kansas over the last few years, and often you'll see a political party use something until it stops working. Okay, so for this to stop working by bringing up Pelosi and Kennedy and Obama and Hillary Clinton, a Democrat has to win. So as some will point out, the Republicans have won 30 plus races in Kansas since 2010. So they're going to keep doing what they're doing. And that's what he said. Why should we stop? It works. So I think this will be one of the biggest, yes, relatively, because of the spending, because it's relatively easy to buy airtime in Topeka, it'll be one of the biggest races, actually, nationally for the Republicans and Democrats here in the 2nd District.
That's Bob Beatty, professor of political science at Washburn University in Topeka. He's part of an Insight Kansas panel previewing the 2018 Kansas primary elections. Before that, we heard from Burdette Loomis of the University of Kansas and Ed Flinchy, formerly of Wichita State University. Coming up, we'll hear from Dwayne Gosin, former budget director for the state of Kansas, and Michael Smith of Emporia State University. I'm Kay McIntyre. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. From the University of Kansas, this is Kansas Public Radio, 91.5 Lawrence and 89.7 Emporia. We're on the web at kansaspublicradio.org. Because you care, donate to KPR today for unbiased, in-depth news, for inspiration and laughs, for thoughtful conversations, and a more informed life. You are an essential part of the equation. Your contribution to KPR equals unparalleled local coverage, captivating storytelling, and a window to the world. Donate at kansaspublicradio.org/support. Stand up, count yourself in, and make a difference today. The 2018 primary election season kicked off this week with 4 states holding primary elections. Today on KPR Presents, how are things shaping up heading toward the August primaries in Kansas? Coming up, former state budget director Dwayne Gosin. But first, Michael Smith of Emporia State University with a look at the race for Kansas's 3rd District, which includes Johnson and Wyandotte counties.
Wyandotte County is one of the two really blue counties in the state of Kansas. Should be a good Democratic base, except Wyandotte County consistently suffers from very low voter turnout. They've got to get their voters out. And unfortunately, midterm elections are not the best for that. Your best shot is the presidential election. Even in a state like Kansas, which is not in play, it still brings out more voters. Johnson County is one of the top 25 counties in the nation for Romney to Clinton switching voters. These were the voters that were supposed to keep Hillary Clinton safe with her run for the White House. We did not bank on the fact that there would be two Obama to Trump switching voters for every one Romney to Clinton switching voter. But they do not live in Johnson County. They live in Ohio, they live in Wisconsin, they live in other places. Johnson County was the center of Romney to Clinton switching voters. So Romney easily won Johnson County in 2012, won it by 10 points. And then Hillary Clinton goes and wins it in 2016, although you'll note that those numbers don't add up. The Clinton 47, Trump 46. A lot of people either voting for third party candidates or, like a friend of mine who lives in Johnson County, just left the top of the ballot blank. But you do see this huge drop in the Republican turnout, and some of that went to Clinton. And it's very regional. You know, I like regional politics. You know, the term campaign, political campaign, comes from battle campaign. I think politics is very territorial. And it's pretty clear what's going on here. Within I-435, Johnson County's turning blue. And this is a pattern we see in a lot of older suburbs all over the country. Inner ring suburbs are coming demographically and politically to represent central cities. What we would call the suburbs, if this were the 1970s, is really the outer ring suburbs, the stereotypical, not very diverse, lots of new housing, very Republican. Gardner, DeSoto, Lewisburg, they still vote that way. But Prairie Village doesn't. Roland Park doesn't. Mission doesn't. This place is turning blue. And so it shows this sort of blue growth that puts this community into play. What I did was I pulled the FEC, latest FEC report for the entire district. Kevin Yoder's at the bottom. Of course, he easily is raising the most money, 600 and some thousand the most recent quarter. He's got well over $1 million in the bank. And in terms of these Democrats, there's no clear pattern yet. You know, with a lot of these races, it's kind of a winnowing down process. I don't want to mischaracterize what Ed or Bird had to say, but it does look to me like we have a Republican race that is narrowing to a Collier-Kobach race and a Democratic race that's narrowing to a Kelly-Swati race. Don't mean to discount those other candidates, but we see that some candidates have withdrawn from the race. It's narrowing. And that's kind of important if you're going to mount a serious candidate in the fall. And I don't see that in the 3rd District. We're all over the place here. But here's where we are right now. Davids is a very interesting candidate. She is an LGBT activist. She is LGBT herself. She's lesbian. She's relatively young, 37 years old, interned in the Obama White House during the Trump transition. And is also a Native American. So she's really running on her identity as well as her connection to the Obama White House. She is one of the folks that are kind of staking out the liberal side in the Democratic race, the other one being Welder. Welder actually worked for the Bernie Sanders campaign, and he is reminding voters of that anytime he possibly can. He also has a raft of union endorsements, which that district is not the ideal place for that. If you lived across the state line in the 5th District of Missouri, that would be great. I don't know how much that's going to help him in the Kansas 3rd, but he's really pushing the Bernie connection and really running to the left. So those are the two candidates in the Democratic race I see as running to the left. The two I see as running to the center. Nierman is the first one. He is a teacher. Has raised the most money of any of the Democrats. He's well into the three figures. I think he's got about $300,000 or $400,000 in the bank now. His just whole campaign has a very professional look to it. You know, one of the things you notice about the folks that have hired professional campaign managers and are working with the party and so forth is their statements on issues tend to get more vague. You know, so if you look at like somebody like Welder's website, it will say, we need to ban assault weapons. And if you look at Nierman's website, it says, we need common sense gun laws. That's, you know, you can tell who's hired the professional consultants because they're still position taking, but they keep it vague. They don't want to say things they can be held accountable for later or nailed on for a certain vote. And Nierman is really stressing the education theme. A little bit problematic running for Congress because, of course, Congress has less jurisdiction over the schools than if he were running for, say, the state legislature, where I think a lot of folks would be all over that. And there have been a lot of teachers elected to the state legislature. But he is stressing the teacher side running for Congress and being a teacher himself. The other, what I would call the centrist, sort of the conventional wisdom kind of candidate is Williams. She has a background as an accountant, again, has done very well with the fundraising. And once again, when you look at her website and so forth, you see a lot of these kind of things, common sense gun laws, and popular issues like keep the protection for pre-existing conditions in the Affordable Care Act, which is very popular, as opposed to keep the individual mandate, which is the part that pays for that, but which is less politically popular, and she doesn't mention that piece. And so, roughly speaking, on the left, it is Welder and Davids that are really starting to stand out. And on in the center, it's Williams and Nierman. Jay Seide was the candidate last time, but he got into some controversy with Democrats who questioned his strategy to stop campaigning right before the election. And he's not doing so well. And then Andrea Ramsey was an interesting one, healthcare executive. Dropped out due to sexual harassment allegations. One of the only cases I've heard of, high-profile cases of female against male allegations of sexual harassment. And she withdrew from the race and endorsed Welder, the Bernie Sanders supporter. One more kind of interesting note, Welder does not live in Johnson County. He lives in the district, but he lives in Wyandotte County. Now, the conventional political wisdom would say that's a no-no. Johnson County is the political center of the district. That's where you live. But he lives in Bonner Springs in western Wyandotte County. So we'll see how that plays out. There are other candidates in the race, there are, including some that have gotten some recognition. There's one deaf activist, but he is not raising significant amounts of money. So we'll see where that goes. What kind of conclusions can we draw, if any? First of all, just a heads up, Democrats, 270 to win still has this district as leaning Republican. It did vote for Hillary Clinton, but Kevin Yoder won his most recent race by 10 points. So it is not in the bag for Democrats, but Democrats are choosing to contest it, and for obvious reasons. For his part, Yoder is a fundraising machine. He's doing very, very well bringing in the money, and he seems to be following a strategy of avoiding conflict. He has most notably chosen not to attend a number of town hall meetings about guns and gun issues. And I've heard before that in Johnson County in particular, that's an issue you can't win on. You will lose the votes of people on the other side if you take a stand on that. And he seems to be following that conventional wisdom, but of course then getting dinged for hiding for his constituents, from his constituents. We'll see. I already mentioned you've got two kind of centrist or what some people would call electable candidates. If you buy that, the Democrats have to be centrist to be electable. I don't always. But you've got two candidates, Nierman and Williams, that fit that bill, and then two strong liberal alternatives right now. What are the issues going to be? Trump, very polarizing. And again, he didn't win that district, but it was close. Johnson's County's not Trump country. So it could work against Yoder. We'll see. Guns, all of the Democrats, all of the significant Democrats have taken stands in favor of some sort of gun control on their website. And again, Yoder has this issue with the town hall. And that's just the conventional wisdom says that's a big issue in the suburbs. So we're going to be hearing about guns, maybe quite a bit. And we're not going to hear about guns the same way you're going to be hearing about in the second district.
That's Michael Smith of Emporia State University speaking at Washburn University in Topeka on April 26, 2018. Dwayne Gosin served as the budget director for the state of Kansas for 12 years, serving under Republican Governor Bill Graves and Democratic Governors Kathleen Sebelius and Mark Parkinson. He writes and speaks about Kansas budget and financial issues.
Bob did a very nice job at the beginning of this panel outlining two big significant things that have caught national attention in Kansas. In 2012, we got dramatic income tax cuts that were proportionally deeper and more dramatic than what any other state has done. That yielded up a budget crisis and a very difficult financial situation in Kansas. And then in 2016, and as a result of that, we had elections where the legislature changed pretty significantly. A third of the legislature overturned or changed. There was a new person in a third of the legislative seats. And that newly configured legislature then proceeded to essentially reverse the tax cuts of 2012. Now, going forward into the 2018 elections, the key question, as Bob outlined, hanging over everything is, are we going back to the Brownback period, or are we going to go forward in some way? And the governor's race is certainly going to answer that question partially, but I think just as important to answering that question will be, how do the legislative races come out that are going to be held in Kansas? No Kansas senators are up for election, but every member of the 125-member House is up for election. And those races are going to be really hard fought. Remember, last year, to reverse the 2012 tax cuts, that took a veto override. More than two-thirds of the current sitting House members voted to do that, a majority of Republicans and essentially all of the Democrats. And that vote, that's going to be the key vote in a lot of legislative races going forward. And how voters answer that will tell us a lot about where we're headed. Already, opposition to that vote or opponents of that vote have sent thousands and thousands of postcards into the districts of the legislators who, both Republican and Democrat, who voted to override that veto last year. So we've got an interesting time ahead of us. Let me say it this way, quite a number of those legislators were new and ran on the platform in 2016 of going to Topeka to fix the financial problems that the tax cuts created. And they then proceeded to do that, voting to overturn that veto. Now, the very vote, which will be described by opponents as the largest tax increase in Kansas history, even though it only takes Kansas part of the way back to where things were in 2012, and even though that vote essentially saved Kansas financially, it still will be portrayed as a huge tax increase, and that will be the key issue in a multitude of legislative races and across the state in both rural and urban districts.
Dwayne Gosin served as budget director for the state of Kansas for 12 years. Before that, we heard from Professor Michael Smith of Emporia State University, Burdette Loomis of the University of Kansas, Bob Beatty of Washburn University, and Ed Flinchy, retired from Wichita State University. All of today's panelists write for Insight Kansas, a syndicated newspaper column that reaches about 20 newspapers across the state. This event was recorded on April 26, 2018, by KPR engineer Chuck Smith. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.